AZ.com. It's time for our regular visit. So it's about monthly now with Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, the Buckmaster Show contributor on agriculture, professor of extension, specialist in agronomy and soil science at the University of Arizona Department of Environmental Science. His responsibilities include leading a program directed toward the development of irrigated crop production management strategies that optimize the economic and environmental impacts of a soil plant system. Professor Silvertooth is a fellow for both the American Society of Agronomy and for the Soil Science Society of America. And he's a really good guy and very knowledgeable on lots of topics. Good to see you, Jeff.
Good to see you, Bill. Thank you.
Everybody's talking about the slap heard around the world. I'm sure you've got thoughts as well. The anger, we touched on a little bit of this at the beginning of the Monday political face-off. Jeff, it's not, I said it's emblematic what we saw out of actor Will Smith last night of this whole thing that the people just are so frustrated, whether it's the fights that you see in the mall, out on the road, you travel all over Arizona.
Right.
You see it all the time.
You see that. You know, what you also see is most people are trying to be cool.
Yeah.
Trying to get along.
Yes, they are.
Most people want to get along, and that's the thing I know. But just a few, it's like it always is in life, it seems like. It's just a few that kind of had a tendency to stir things up. But, you know, it has a tendency to be a little bit contagious, you
mm-hmm.
know. And that's, I think, what you and other folks are commenting on is the degree of that contagion of the anger and frustration that's running around in the country. You know, I'm like a lot of Americans, who just general citizen. I watch it. I have concerns about it. I just watch the things that are changing in our communities all over the place mm-hmm. or around us, and mm-hmm. have concerns about that. When I really believe in the heart of things, most people want to get along and want to have a peaceful life here together. Mm-hmm. So I find that's where my frustration lies.
Most people just want to as you said, kind of be cool. Take a deep breath, you know, we're going to get through this. We all have challenges in life.
Right.
I mean, we've all got things going on, issues that are on our mind. And if somebody, you know, is going to cut you off in traffic, don't react. Don't do any kind of reaction, because it could actually, in this town, I hate to say it could cost you your life.
Well, it could, but if you start spending energy on that one outfit that cuts you off, well, you get ready, because you're going to have a whole bunch more, so you might as well just sit back and relax and try to run your show, run your life the best you can, you know, same as in a vehicle as in just general personal life, you know, I think, you know.
Jeff, you've traveled internationally. You've been to Russia now 10 times, consulting on agriculture over there. And you, I know, are very concerned, and we all should be, about Ukraine. And it's already happening, I guess, the food shortage worldwide.
Well, that's going to have an impact. The Ukraine area, the Ukraine region, and the nation of Ukraine for sure have been the breadbasket of Europe for centuries. And it's been, of course, oscillating back and forth under various political regimes over the centuries, but it's always had this production capacity. It has the unique characteristics that we look for in an ideal agricultural region with regard to beautiful soils. And as an agronomy student at Kansas State University in the early mm-hmm. 70s, mm-hmm. that was impressed upon me that we were living in that time in the middle of the United States Great Plains, these mm-hmm. beautiful soils that have been developed under grassland ecosystems. At other places in the world where those kinds of soils exist, Ukraine is one of them, and Russia, although they exist at a higher latitude, so they don't have quite the productivity of our, particularly the southern Great Plains of the United States, but it was recognized and impressed upon us as agronomy students then in the 70s that Ukraine and the Ukrainian region is a very important, it's the breadbasket of Europe, it's a very important production region for the world, and particularly for that part of the world, and it certainly is today. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, and that's when the Ukraine has become a nation. Mm-hmm. After the fall of the Soviet Union, they have more than 10 times increased their agricultural productivity. And they've become a major exporter on the world market, particularly of grain crops. And they produce most of the grains that go into almost half the grains that the Europeans consume in North Africa and the Middle East, particularly.
And the Caribbean, the very impoverished nation of Haiti. I did not know this. I learned this recently, that Haiti depends on Ukrainian wheat, and
right.
they always seem to be in a food shortage problem anyway.
Right.
Now, over the past month, and I think we're coming up tomorrow, will be the 5-week anniversary of this war, all of the infrastructure and getting that grain out, I guess it's not happening.
Well, it's going to be certainly being disrupted. Production, harvesting, planting, as well as the capacity to export. You know, there, for example, the 40%, more than 40% of the corn and wheat that goes into the Mideast and North Africa is coming out of Ukraine.
Mm.
And it's coming out of those ports on the Black Sea. Of course, those are of major strategic importance to anybody, the Russians in this case, invading them, trying to get control of those ports.
Mm-hmm. So nothing's moving out of those ports.
No, no. Yeah. And those nations, you consider some of the nations, other nations that have been, you know, chronicled in the reports that I've read.
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to take some time and study this in the past few weeks because it's germane, of course, to what the arena we're working in. But, you know, they've got a export going into nations like Yemen and Bangladesh, and that's going to throw them out on the world market to look for a replacement of that grain. And world market prices are going up, and that's what's going to impact all of us around the world. So when you have a major supplier of world exports, as the Ukrainian region has been and it currently is, it's going to create a major disruption on world markets, whether we like it or not.
Are we a major supplier? Are we a major exporter, the United States?
Absolutely. We're a major exporter of grains. But if you take Russia and Ukraine together, they represent about 1/3 of the wheat crop.
Do they really?
And the production in the world. They consume a lot internally. But as I say, as Ukraine has entered into the world market. So just in terms of their overall agricultural capacity in the world market, just to give you an example, they're number 3 in the world in wheat market, in wheat production and exportation. They're number 1 in sunflower.
Really?
Oil exportation in the world. They're also number 3 in rapeseed, which is an oilseed crop. They're number 2 in barley production and exportation in the world, and number 4 in corn.
Hmm.
You know, that represents approximately on each of those fractions about 20% of total global production.
Can we step up to do anything for these people?
Well, that's a good question. You know, what is happening? You know, grain prices, particularly you see corn and wheat, I watch those regularly. They're going up pretty rapidly in response. They were going up anyway just because of demand and production conditions, other production conditions around the world. But yeah, that most definitely. So as those prices go up, you'll see farmers respond. This is what farmers do. They respond to markets if they can. And that's what I've seen more. I don't have a quantitative estimate on it, but it looks like to me we have more wheat in Arizona this year than normally. We have always a lot of wheat, particularly Durham wheat. We produce soft wheat. It's mainly used for pasta and pasta-type
products. I didn't know that we were much of a wheat producer in Arizona.
Very much so. In fact, just as a sidebar, if you like pasta, you like Italian pasta.
Yeah.
Most of that Italian pasta, the wheat that makes it, it's coming from Arizona and the southwest United States. No, absolutely.
What part of Arizona does
particularly,
this?
Particularly central and southwestern Arizona. Central Arizona, we're losing the water this year. And then southwest Arizona, lower Colorado River Valley, Yuma area particularly. Beautiful wheat production out of there. That's that Durham wheat that's exported to Italy. And they make pasta and they ship it back to us and put an Italian flag on it.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea.
Yes, sir.
We'll talk about after the break about the water situation with Jeff Silvertooth. But right now we'll take a break on the Buckmaster Show. We'll be right back with Jeff. I'm Jeff Silvertooth with me in studio. Jeff, I know you like that area very much.
Yeah, I love New Mexico. All of it, actually. Yeah.
So much to do over there, hiking in the Gila National Wilderness, just hanging out in Silver City, some beautiful Victorian architecture. For what to do and where to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. Jeff Silvertooth with me in studio. Dr. Silvertooth, professor and extension specialist in agronomy and soil science at the University of Arizona Department of Environmental Science. We're talking in one of the reasons I do this program every day, Monday through Friday, noon, is to learn something. And Jeff always teaches me something about agriculture and agronomy that I did not know. I did not know about the wheat that is sent from Arizona to Italy, where it is then they put on the Italian flag and say that it's made, the pasta is made in Italy. Then it comes back and people in Arizona have it for their spaghetti.
Yeah, I have several packages in my kitchen right now. But that's true. We produce the wheat. They do make the pasta there. As a matter of fact, some of those companies were thinking, well, why don't we cut our costs for shipping? back and forth with the wheat and then the pasta and just do it right out there. But of course, then there's this problem they have. They can't call it Italian pasta.
No. You know? What about water for wheat? Does it need a lot of wheat? I mean, does wheat for the growing cycle need a lot of water?
It depends what you call a lot. It's not as much as, say, not as much as cotton because we grow wheat. We plant it typically around Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. harvested in May and June. You can plant all the way up into February in some parts of the state, the Durham wheats that we grow. So it's growing in a cooler part of the year, but it does require water, basically about 3 acre feet of water. But here's the bottom line. Any crop that we produce is going to use water if we want it to produce dry matter or production material. That's just what we harvest. So we harvest the grain. We measure it in terms of a weight, a dry weight, and that takes water to produce. Basically, it takes 6 parts of water for every part of every molecule of carbon that's fixed in a basic sugar molecule through photosynthesis. So it's a fundamental fact of life. The crops that use more water, like you mentioned, cotton or alfalfa, corn, they're growing up warmer types of the year. The plants transpire and cool themselves just like our swamp coolers do to cool us. It's the same physical principle. So it takes water. And each crop will have a commensurate amount of water in relation to what it produces and the environment in which it's grown. So yes, wheat takes a significant amount of water, not as much as some of the other summer warm season crops, and probably a little bit more than we have as some of our vegetable crops.
Just getting enough water right now is a huge issue for not only California announcing that farmers are going to have to take a huge hit. The water agencies over there, Jeff, they are now slashing supplies because of this record drought.
Absolutely. So are we in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So we're undergoing right now, beginning in 2022, the first implementation of the Tier 1 reductions associated with the drought contingency plan, which was agreed upon in 2019 by the lower basin states. That means Arizona, Central Arizona farmers that take CAP, Central Arizona Project water from the Colorado River, are low priority. So right now, they're the first ones to take a cut. They're taking a cut of 512,000 acre feet here in Arizona right now. That represents 65% of their water that goes into those irrigation districts, mainly in Pinal County, just to the north of us, which is a major producing area of wheat, which you just mentioned before. So there'll be some reduction of their capacities to do that. Probably about 65% of their production capacity is going out this year, unless they can supplement that with groundwater. That's what they're scrambling and trying to do.
Are they trying to do that?
They're trying to do that. But
we don't want to use our groundwater. Well,
that's right. It's already in an active management area. And so there's in an effort to try to conserve that groundwater. So there's two parts to that. The infrastructure, the pumps required, the energy required goes along with that to pump water, which is now it's more costly water. But then also, too, it's a finite supply. So none of us want to have to do that. But under the circumstances of this drought, that's what they're having to do, at least in the short term.
The mega drought in the United States, Jeff, as you know, has produced the driest 2 decades in the region in at least 1,200 years. This is such a big deal, and not only for those all consumers, but for your industry, Jeff, this is going to be a huge shakeup.
It already is.
It's going to shake out some suppliers.
Absolutely. It's projected right now. We're probably going to go into Tier 2. We're going to probably go into Tier 2 this next summer. And Tier 2A. Tier 2A happens when the levels of the water at Lake Mead drop to 1,050 feet. And then when that Tier 2B is 1,045. Those reductions, we just have larger bites into our allocation, reductions in our allocation. The concern we have is to go into Tier 3. Tier 3 drops us down to where now we'll start seeing reductions in water allocations into the metropolitan and industrial, other industries. Before that, it's primarily agriculture and Indian nations that are taking the cuts in Tier 1 and Tier 2. So it's important to point out right now that as we see these reductions taking place in Arizona and in the Southwest, the current reductions are directing strictly to agriculture.
But could they get to the point where they would hit all of us?
At Tier 3, they will. So what we're also seeing is efforts being done on the Colorado River to restructure the laws, restructure the agreements on allocation. For example, I just got caught up at a conference I attended here recently, and I read more about it. It's just beginning. So discussions are being held to go back and look at the original compact on the Colorado River, which was agreed to in 1922. which structured the water allocations on the Colorado, saying that it was based on a one-year flow. It was all budgeted in 1922 at the original compact at 15 million acre feet. That's 7.5 million acre feet for the northern basin, upper basin above Lake Powell, and 7.5 million acre feet below in the lower basin below Lake
Powell.
Did you
say 1922?
1922, 100 years ago. It was based on 1 year of hydrological data, which happened to be a wet year. So they budgeted the river at 15 million acre feet. But what we've seen, the average has been, particularly in the last few decades, more or less like 13 to 12 acre, million acre feet. So we've already got a structural deficit. So you can imagine how that would work with your finances at home. You're going to run into a debt sooner or later. So the discussions are taking place right now is to restructure that entire budget for the upper basin and lower basin allocations to something like 12 million acre feet and see if that. Some folks say we ought to go all the way to 9.
So the pie shrinks.
The pie has shrunk. It's just like you and I take a cut in pay. We've got to readjust our expenditures or else we go into debt.
But the problem, Jeff, it's obvious. The other piece, the players, nobody wants to take less.
Well, there you go.
So, you've got a smaller pie. Now you've got a very small piece of the pie.
Well, there's the politics. And I'd have to say, there's something encouraging that's taken place. In 2019, all those players, all those people that are enjoying those pieces of the water pie, so to speak, in the lower basin, came together and agreed upon the drought contingency plan.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of us recognize it's absolutely necessary. You mentioned California.
Yeah.
California is the big player out here because they have the money and they have the people. They have the political power. There's an old saying in the West, water doesn't flow to where... Gravity doesn't control where water flows. Water flows where there's money.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a joke, but there's a little truth to it. And California's at the table, and they're trying to work it out with us, you know, on the other states in the lower basin.
Jeff, could you answer Richard's question, which just came in via email? Jeff, how about the 100-year water supply that subdivisions allegedly have to provide? Could you give a comment to Richard, please?
Yes, sir. That's a good question, Richard. Thank you. One of the things that's a concern is when we have what we call paper water versus wet water. And so we paper water would be where the subdivisions are saying we're guaranteeing a 100-year supply. They don't have the water right now.
Well, you could say anything.
They're saying they're based upon his history and the allocations. But there is a concern that we've allowed an over-allocation on these optimistic budgets. One of the other concerns connects back into, for example, the 15 million acre feet that the river's been budgeted to provide when it's actually providing about 12 to 13 million acre feet. So that difference, that differential could be allocated on paper to say, we have that water. I mean, theoretically, mm-hmm. I have that water in Arizona, mm-hmm. and we can now build these houses, do these other things, you know, build this industry. And that is a concern. And that's why that's exactly, Richard, why I think it's important if we go back. And I like to see the possibility, at least reconsidering what the original 1922 compact provided, because it's not going to solve the drought, but it's going to make us budget the water more realistically. And, of course, this is where agriculture comes into the big play, because agriculture uses almost 70% of the fresh water in this state. So, you know, of course, a lot of people would say who aren't interested in they're not interested in agriculture until they eat supper or breakfast or something. But they would come to say, well, if agriculture uses that water, we got plenty of water. Just take it away from them.
Yeah.
Well, then it has repercussions on things, you know, like
trickle down.
Yeah, your food prices, you know, yeah. et cetera.
Okay, Jeff Silvertooth, until next time, next month, thank you very much.
Very good, sir. Thank you.
All right.